Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to the risk takers, the game changers, and the disruptors. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mindshift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. More than 2 million Californians identified as more than one race in the 2020 census, and many more of us have ancestors who make us a mix of ethnicities. There's something distinct and interesting about the perspective you get straddling worlds and cultures. These experiences are the subject of a new KQED series by Sasha Coca and Marisa Lagos. It's called Mixed: Stories of Mixed-Race Californians, and we'll spend the hour listening to their reporting and hearing your experiences of mixed families here in the Bay Area. That's all coming up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking about the new series Mixed from KQED's California Report magazine, which documents and explores the experiences of people who defy the simple racial and ethnic categories that our government has codified. Let's listen in to their little opener.
The most common question that I got growing up was, what are you?
I just never understood why can't you include all of me?
You know, where do I fit in? Who do I identify with?
I need all my mixed people to talk about it. Express yourself, your perspective.
I'm mixed and I'm proud of it. Being myself and having an awesome family.
I have always been a mixed person. I wouldn't know how to think of myself otherwise, and I'm not planning on changing.
As you might be able to hear just from that short intro, Mixed identifies where our experiences might be distinct from those whose parents share a race or country of origin, and also where that very mixedness might be something we share with each other, if not with our parents. Here to chat this morning, we've got the creators of the new series here in Studio B. Sasha Coca, welcome.
Hey, Alexis. So great to be here. Thank you.
And Marisa Lagos, welcome to you, too.
Good morning.
I want to know, Sasha, let's start with you. I mean, this is obviously a personal project for y'all. You consider yourselves mixed in this way. Did you think about this a lot growing up, or was it something that you kind of came into as an adult?
You know, I feel like I really came into it as a teenager. I grew up in LA. My father's from India. My mom is Irish American. And in our family, we talked about being bicultural, but we never really talked about being multiracial. And when I was 15, I went to this camp outside of Los Angeles in the mountains called Brotherhood Sisterhood. It was kind of a radical camp where we talked about racism and sexism and all this different kind of stuff. And the first day, I got put in a group for mixed kids. And I walked into that group and I just burst into tears. I felt like I had come home being with other people, even if their identities were totally different than mine. Like, you know, a black father and a white mother, or a Japanese and a Samoan parentage, whatever it was, we had something in common in terms of feeling like outsider insiders and like we never truly fit in any one space.
So for you, what's different about being, you know, say, quote, bicultural from being, quote, mixed?
Wow. I mean, I think for every person, they kind of have to come to that understanding for themselves. I mean, Alexis, you're mixed too. And I think we should call that out that, you know,
sure,
all of us kind of come to that identity. race is still an organizing principle in the United States, even though we know it's a social construct. And I think for me, South Asian is so complicated because we're looped in with all of these other Asian groups, and South Asians often feel like, wait, we're not East Asian, we're closer to Iranians. So, I mean, it's all kind of a construct. But for me, the mixed label feels like a homecoming because it feels like it embraces the fact that there's complexity and there's nuance and that we don't just check one box. And by the way, the boxes are ridiculous.
Yes.
Marisa, how about you? How did you grow up in this way? You're from San Diego, right?
Right. So I just will say at the outset, like, I still have a lot of ambivalence about even claiming being mixed race. I feel like because I have Mexican heritage and a Latino sounding name, I mean, my last name is Mexican, but I grew up in San Diego in a not a super culturally Mexican household. I was actually probably closer to my Armenian heritage in that house. My great grandmother, who fled Armenia before the genocide, was actually alive when I was a kid. So, like, she taught us how to cook and sort of, like, created that sense of home. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like I've always had a lot of, like, almost like guilt or ambivalence about claiming my Mexican heritage because I don't speak great Spanish. And I didn't sort of, you know, fit in within, you know, what unfortunately remain sort of segregated schools, even if they're self-segregated, mm-hmm. like with the Mexican kids. And my parents, even though, you know, my dad grew up in San Francisco, he's mixed. He didn't claim that. Like, that was not how he thought of himself, because I think that's a generational thing. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, like, this is really this series, this conversation with Sasha, this conversation with the people in our series and our listeners is almost me starting to claim that. But I do want to go to the box thing, because that to me was like the real, like, concrete example of this sort of uncertainty around how to claim myself. I never understood as a kid. I was like, what does that mean? Like, non-Latino or non-Hispanic white, or how do I do this? And I do think, and we'll get into some of this probably, that those of us who have some skin privilege or who have, you know, white in the mix, are always a little unsure about how much we're allowed to kind of claim. Mm-hmm. And then in general, just being mixed, like, the idea is you are between spaces. And, you know, we're going to talk to one of our guests later about this idea of sort of being able to claim your own identity and that we're all allowed to. But I think that is something that, especially at our age, we're all in our 40s, let's just say it. I think it's a conversation that's really evolved over our lifetime, and it's changed, and more people are claiming this. But, I still get pushback even from friends who are like, oh, like, how do you identify, or what are you? And it's like, you know what?
Hispanic Journalists Association.
Yeah, like, why are you speaking at NAHJ, the Hispanic Journalists Association? You know, and it's like, you know, I'm not an immigrant. I don't have those experiences, but that's not what actually, like, claiming your racial background is about.
Yeah, right. One of the people that you talked to, I said, put it beautifully. She was like, well, your ancestors are all there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're all those, you are part of all of those people. For me, my background is on the table here too. I mean, I ended up thinking about this a ton because when I was 10, we moved from Los Angeles, where essentially being Mexican, or like in my case, having a Mexican dad, and we moved to rural Washington, where suddenly, you know, having a Mexican dad was something notable rather than basically ubiquitous,
right,
where
right.
I was growing up in Los Angeles.
Like, you went from being an insider to an outsider.
Yeah. And it was such an interesting thing because I think both for me and for my sister, it was like we came into this ethnic or racial consciousness, like, really in a snap. Like, mm-hmm. it was sort of like we drove up I-5 and suddenly we were like, whoa, we really need to think about this in a different way.
Which gets to, I think, what, like, is at the core of a lot of this is that, like, identity is both about what your ancestry is and how you identify, but it also has to do with how the world perceives you. And we have little to no control over that. And I think that that is where some of, the heartache can come in.
But what we do have control over is when we get that question, what are you, which a lot of us get our whole life, is claiming our own identity and defining that for ourselves rather than letting other people say, you know, you're not quite enough. Right.
Like, or if even I go to your own family.
Right. Even your own family. Oh, you're not Indian enough. Oh, you're not Mexican enough. Oh, no, you know, I think it's really about just coming into our own ownership of ourselves and being ready with an answer for that question. What are you? And also saying, I'm not part this and part that. I'm whole. Mm-hmm. I am this and that.
Yeah. I once had a really interesting conversation with some of my cousins from Mexico who were talking about my dad as perhaps not being Mexican enough. Right. I was like, man, if you're born there, you grow up there till 18, and then you come to the U.S., you're really not Mexican enough. And I was like, man, if even they're willing to go there, then, you know, I need to, like, let this go, that my Mexican cousins will somehow be like, yes, you are Mexican.
And that really, I think we have to acknowledge, like, community and geography, because I always joke, like, nobody would, you know, if you said I'm German or I'm Japanese in California, nobody would say you're not really German unless you speak German. But being Mexican, there is that sense, right? And I think that that is a challenge. And then if you go to another state, like, to your point, Alexis, that would look very, very different.
Yeah. We're talking about the experience being mixed. This is a piece of KQED's series Mixed Stories of Mixed Race Californians, which is really running on the California Report magazine. We're joined by Sasha Coca, host of the magazine, and Marisa Lagos, KQED politics correspondent, co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown show, and Sasha's partner in this Mixed series. We would love to hear from you. This is such a great caller show. We know that there's a lot of folks in the audience who identify with these issues based on previous shows. Are you mixed? How do you end up describing yourself to other people? They asked a great question in their reporting. What's something only fellow mixed folks understand about growing up mixed? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. The email is forum at kqed.org. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or KQED Forum. I do want to set a little bit of the structural context for this, which is just, this is a very California story. Maybe it's a Hawaii story too, which has a higher percentage of mixed people, but it's a very California story.
Yeah, I mean, California is the place with the biggest number of mixed race people in the nation. And I mean, we saw this explosive jump in the census in terms of how many people identify as mixed race. California is also the birthplace of the multiracial movement. I mean, this is the place where people got together and said, hey, you know those boxes on the census? Not working for us. I don't want to have to choose one or the other. We are also home to the longest running course in mixed race studies in the United States, which was taught both at UCLA and at University of California, Santa Barbara. So we are really at the cutting edge of this conversation. And you're right, Hawaii does have more mixed race people per capita, but we're a bigger state. And we've got, I think, about some 2 million people who identified as mixed race on the last census.
Yeah. You know, one other census note, which is, I think there might be some people out there who are thinking to themselves, oh, Hispanic or Latino is an ethnicity, not a race. I mean, we hear people say this a lot. We did a show on this one time, and we had, like, the scholar on, like, Latino racial formation, and it just turns out it's a lot more complicated than that.
That's right. I mean, Latinidad is a social construct. South Asian is a social construct. Race in itself is a social construct. But, you know, it's still a way that we organize and allocate power here in the U.S.
And I think it's more complicated because we have, like, better science now. So people are doing these DNA tests and finding out, I mean, most of us are mixed in some way, right? And you know, that's something we get into, particularly with Reginald Daniel, who taught that mixed race course and is Black and, you know, but wanted to look into his own kind of history of his family and got a lot of pushback for asking those questions. I know, yeah, when one of my family members did our DNA, like, I mean, Mexican as a construct to some extent is mestizo, right? Like, you have, not that everybody's a mix of everything, but a lot of Mexicans have indigenous blood, have Spanish blood, have African blood. And so how do you, yeah, think about that, deconstruct that, like, what can you identify with? I think it's a really personal question ultimately.
Yeah. And I think it's just, you know, we have these boxes and we end up fitting our own complex understandings of them and simplifying them into those categories that you see on the census, which is why, as the census evolves, I think the way we talk about all this evolves too.
And our kids are going to be talking about it totally differently.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We're talking about the experience of being mixed. We are celebrating KQED's series, Mixed Stories of Mixed Race Californians, with its creators, Sasha Coca, host for the California Report magazine, and Marisa Lagos, KQED politics correspondent. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more right after the break. Dirty my clothes, this a vote with my uncle on Vogue and my cousin on Vogue. Wide open, how I come in your lane.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. I am joined in Studio B here with Sasha Coca, host for the California Report magazine, KQED, of course, and Marisa Lagos, KQED politics correspondent. They are the creators of a new series for the California Report magazine, Mixed Stories of Mixed Race Californians. Before we bring in another guest, let's hear our first story. Amy in San Francisco, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I stumbled upon this report. This is just amazing because I'm 50 years old and I grew up in the Bay Area, in like South Bay. And it was at a time where, I am half Japanese and I'm a quarter Portuguese and a quarter German. And so it was crazy because where I grew up at the time, even though it's super, Asian where my parents are now, the time there was pretty much no mixed race kids there, and I was sent to Japanese school on Saturdays, and I was, you know, regular school during the week. And it was crazy because when I went to regular school, they would always make fun of me for being Asian, and I used to get all kinds of Asian slurs, and I used to get tortured all the time as an Asian kid. But then I'd go to Japanese school. And I would get made fun of for being white. And it's like, I just never seem to...
Doesn't seem fair. Doesn't seem fair, Amy.
Never enough.
No. It was never enough. And there was a picture of me in 1978 where my mom dressed me up. It was at the San Jose Buddhist Church where we did the Obon Odori there. And I was in my little kimono and everything. And they had made a comment about how, you know, oh, I look so cute, but I'm... you know, half Japanese. And so it's like they pointed that out. And I remember the first time I went to Hawaii, though I'm not from Hawaii, I got there and people actually treated me like a local because my mix is relatively common there.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing feeling. For the first time, I was like, wow, like there's so many people here that are so like me. And that's just so weird. And it was a very crazy thing. And I feel like the last sort of click was those boxes, those damn boxes, right? For years, I would check Japanese because you could only check one, right?
Yep.
And then within recent times, they said, you know, two or more. And then I started to like, you know, I would deliberately try to check two or whatever. And they finally started having that box that said, you know, two or more there. And it's just, it's, although it is a social construct, it's crazy, like you said, how other people perceive you and then how it affects you as an individual growing up. And it's just, I just thank you for doing this report.
Thank you for the call.
You know, Amy brings up something that one of our guests has done a lot of work on, which is the question, Joemi Ito, who's an educator in the East Bay, but also does a lot of activism around kind of pushing back against cultural appropriation and fashion. But we have this conversation because like when you're mixed, like, yeah, like if you know, Sasha wears a sari or if Amy, you know, wears a kimono, like there are people who are going to sort of question that. But like, that's not fair at all. Like, why is only part of you allowed to claim that heritage? Why would you be pushed into being white, but say that you can't do that? And I think it's a really fascinating, like, very layered
question. I love Joemi told us that it feels like a cultural hug when she wears her kimono. Yeah. It's like a hug from her ancestors. But she is pushing back against non-Japanese designers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Using kimonos and Japanese fabrics.
She was pretty clear when, like, you said, I don't know, I felt like, am I allowed to do this? sometimes. She's like, heck yes, you are. You know, like you are Indian, Sasha. You know, and I think sometimes like we, and that's part of like this series, I think just getting that community around us to be like, yeah, you are who you are and you're allowed to be that has been really gratifying for not just the guests, but us, I think.
Yeah. You know, I did want to talk about some of the reporting that's in the series. In particular, this incredible interview you did with Kip Fulbeck. He's an artist who had this photo exhibit. Why don't you set that up for us, Sasha? And then we have a cut of your interview from it.
Absolutely. So Kip Fulbeck is a professor at UC Santa Barbara. Somehow everybody who studies mixed race seems to be at UC Santa Barbara. But,
which is my alma mater.
Yeah.
So I love that.
But he's an incredible artist and photographer. And, you know, back in 2006, my partner is also mixed. He's Japanese and Mexican. Went through a lot of things that Amy did growing up. We went to the Japanese American National Museum in LA because we were trying to get the records from incarceration, from internment, where his father was a little boy in the incarceration camps. And we walked in and we saw these photographs of mixed people all over the walls. And it was part of Kip Fulbeck's Hapa exhibit. He's since done another book called Mixed. In fact, Maya Sotero Ng, Barack Obama's sister, collaborated with him on that. But he is an amazing artist who has given mixed people a platform by taking these photographs and then having people write below those photographs in their own handwriting the words that they use to describe themselves. And it's absolutely fascinating.
Let's listen in to Kip Fulbeck talking about this work.
This project gave people the avenue to actually like say it for themselves. I think people jumped at it. And I had no idea it was going to be received the way it was. People were sick of filling out these forms. Like, you'd pick race, you know, please explain. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to explain. I'm not going to not check one box. It was 2000 before we were able to even check more than one box. And it's still these ridiculous boxes. Non-Hispanic, white. What does that mean?
I know. Preach, Kip, preach.
It's true. We want to add another voice into our conversation here. Let's bring in Dr. Jennifer Noble, psychologist, educator, and coach for families with mixed-race kids. Welcome, Jennifer.
Good morning.
Hey, Dr. Jen.
Hi, Dr. Jen.
Hi. How are you doing?
Doing well. Dr. Jen, I wanted to ask you about something. When Amy called in, you know, she kind of gave a kind of fractional accounting of herself, which I had to stop myself from doing earlier, saying, you know, half Mexican. what is another way we could talk about that aside from kind of doing the pie chart of self?
Which, as I've told Dr. Jen, my mom literally made me when I was a child.
Yeah. And Dr. Jen, I'd love it if you just tell us why fractions are problematic to start with.
Yeah, you know, I just to answer the first question, how you do it is you just list what it is without the fractions. You just put commas or an and instead. So it's not much of an adjustment, really, but it can feel a lot different. And I just feel that, you know, the fractions piece of it, it is breaking you down. And I think because we're such a math-oriented people, we think in numbers and, you know, quantifying everything. And so when you really... You may not realize it, but when you say to yourself, I'm a fourth this or I'm half that, you begin to conceptualize it as, well, I'm less. I'm not whole then. Mm-hmm. So then when someone is like, oh, you know, you're half Indian, in your mind, you're like, yeah, that means I'm not enough of Indian. I'm not fully Indian. I'm not 100%. You know, all those things that make it less. And so I think when you remove that, you give yourself a chance to be like, you know what? I am a part of this altogether. I don't have to quantify it and split myself apart into smaller pieces. Mm. You know, I'm one whole person with these heritages.
You know, Dr. Jen, you know, in your work with families and your own life, have you found that mixed communities in which, you know, maybe parents are predominantly Black and something else, or predominantly white and something else, given the like specific racial history of the United States and our specific set of oppressions, have you found that mixed kids still have a lot in common, even if their parents may be these different races?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I mean, that's from my own personal experience and then just from work that I've done, because I've attended a lot of conferences as, you know, working for a nonprofit here in Southern California. And when you go to these conferences, people can be of so many varieties of backgrounds. But when it comes to certain discussions, all of a sudden everybody's like, oh my God, me too. And yes. You know, so it's there is definitely a shared experience. When you get into the specifics, okay, yes, then there's a little bit of difference there, but absolutely there is a shared experience.
Yeah. Let's bring in another one of these experiences. Sean in San Francisco, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, doing well. Welcome.
Well, you know, I'm 49. I grew up at a time when you were like the one drop rule reigned supreme. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm curious, is this new? I hear people calling my kids mixed, and it drives me crazy, right? Because they're not mixed, right? I want to push back against this like white math concept, right? Of like, it's always showing how much white you have in you, right? How are you going to explain your whiteness so that you are acceptable? That's the way I grew up with this concept, right?
Sean, what do you want your kids to be? How do you refer to your kids?
As whole humans, right? So genetically, I am Black and First Nations, while my partner is of Chinese ethnicity, right? Mm-hmm. So she is all about saying that she's Hapa. Our kids are Hapa, but I don't like that. Like, they're humans, right? Mm-hmm. We're humans, yo. I happen to be Black, right? Yes, half of my ethnicity is First Nations, but for all intents and purposes, when the rest of the world, and especially the police, see me, like, I'm Black,
yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. My daughter will not have that, but she's not half of anything, and she's definitely nowhere close to, like, doing any sorts of, again, what I'm calling white math, right? So how does that fit in with this mixedness?
Yeah.
I'll take my answer.
No, thank you, Sean. I really appreciate that perspective. You know, Dr. Jen, could you talk a little bit about Sean's experience and just the feelings that he's having around, you know, kind of Blackness versus mixedness?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very, very common experience, and there has been a lot of change in a relatively short time. So within one generation, the conceptualization of like identity is shifting. And I think the one drop rule, it has done a lot of damage, but at the same time, so many people have also bought into it. And so when we ask anyone whether it's impacted them negatively or not, it's really hard to let go of this one drop rule of like, no, you're just this. Or, you know, for example, in his case, he's saying, well, I'm Black. I know I'm also something else, but I'm just Black. So I think, to me, I kind of take a note from the generation, like Gen Z folks. Mm-hmm. They really push back against rules of categorization. So they're just like, look, I'm just going to be fully me and authentically me. And I don't care if it follows your rules or not. So I think for his family, he could easily just list all the things. And you know, again, it just goes back to, what are your kids? Yes, they are human. Of course they are. Mm-hmm. But if someone tries to say, oh, but like, let's classify them and what, you know, how much this and how much that, you're like, no, they are. I forgot what he listed again. First Nations, African-American, and was it
Chinese?
Chinese, yes. So that's it. Commas between the three, and let the people, you know, deal with it as they will. Oh, but what are they really, and what are they more? And no, I told you what they are. I answered your question, and my children are just human, and goodbye. You know.
But also, his kids are going to be able to define it for themselves, and he doesn't get to tell them how they identify, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's a big part of this conversation is like, it especially when your mix is different than your parents, you are having a singular experience, right? And so they might have different language than what he's comfortable with. I don't know, you know, they may not. They might agree with him on that. And then he brought up the one drop rule, and I think we just like have to say like that is a huge part of these conversations. Obviously, neither Sasha or I are Black, and so we I've really, you know, tried to give a lot of voice and opportunity to folks to have those conversations, to think about that. And, you know, I think that that's a really common term. But like, I had to look up like, what exactly did that mean? And it was a legal principle. I mean, and it was aimed at both keeping people enslaved and then obviously keeping them in the Jim Crow era from having rights. And it was essentially overturned by a Supreme Court decision, right? Because it wasn't specific to that. But I think that we have to acknowledge repeatedly, like, how much, if you have Black in the mix, it is a different experience in America.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, Sean, thank you so much for that. I mean, we, you know, this is definitely like the stickiest part of this project. And so you talked with a UC Santa Barbara professor named Reginald Daniel, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And we have a clip of him talking. Do you want to set it up? He's kind of talking about his own background.
That's right. I mean, I feel very privileged that we got to talk to Dr. Reg Daniel. In fact, he passed away a few weeks after Marisa and I were able to interview him. He was one of the founders of mixed race studies and was a real groundbreaking racial theorist who taught the longest running class in mixed race studies in the United States, died very suddenly. And he was a very interesting person because his parents identified as Black. He did not have parents who identified as coming from two different races. Mm-hmm. He strongly claimed a mixed identity based on the fact that phenotypically, people in his family, going back, you know, there were white ancestors, and he did not feel like he could just claim Blackness. And he got a lot of pushback for that.
Yeah. I mean, as Sean was indicating, it kind of makes sense because it's about, I think some Black people see this as being about positioning yourself in proximity to whiteness.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's listen in to Reginald Daniel.
Louisville, Kentucky, which is where I grew up, you know, we couldn't eat in Woolworths. We had to, I mean, we couldn't sit at the counters in Woolworth. We had to stand. So I have very clear memories of those. And you grew up with a certain sense of anxiety about appropriate behavior and what things could happen if you crossed the line unwittingly and didn't know. But all of the grandparents are themselves the offspring of what we would consider to be interracial unions. Two of them were not marriages. The other ones were. So there was a sense, I think, a shame about that, that ancestry and the privileges that often come at that time, particularly among African-Americans about being lighter skinned and all this whole kind of thing. So there was a great deal of silence about it. But for me, I was just looking at the world around me and saw a lot of things that nobody wanted to talk about. But then when I began to realize that it's much more complicated than that, and my family was really very silent about it, and they were really uncomfortable with me asking questions about our background and why we look the way we look. I was an outlier throughout my entire life to identify as mixed, and my family was not happy about it.
That was Reginald Daniel, UC Santa Barbara professor, who recently passed away. You know, Dr. Jen, you knew Reginald Daniel. Was his work influential in shaping your own thinking, or did you push back on his work? Like, how did his kind of research and thinking influence your own?
Oh, gosh. No, he was very influential for me, and it was more like inspirational mentor guidance kind of thing, because he was all the conferences that I would go to, he was often a speaker, he was either on a panel, he was leading something, so all of his philosophy and like thought on this, I would just be like, yes, me too, oh my gosh, you know. So it was more of a really, it's like, you know, hanging out with your favorite uncle or something and kind of just listening to what they're saying and the work that they're doing and the new wise thoughts that they have. So I definitely didn't push back. He was just a person that maybe gave me more words and more validation on some of the things that I was already thinking, you know. He was very much a leader in the community, and everyone that was in his presence was just like, he is, if you got to have him on your panel, that was like a big deal.
You know, we have so many good comments coming in. Aaron writes, just kind of with a note, I appreciate that the world reads people as mixed, but there's something of a faulty premise here. It assumes that those that are not mixed are somehow, quote, pure. Even cultures that are supposedly homogenous, for example, Japanese, are just as complex. Mm-hmm. And I think we recognize that and appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Note.
Yes, that's a great point.
Well, you know what? We have so many long and interesting comments. I'm going to wait on it. We are talking about KQED's new series, Mixed Stories of Mixed Race Californians. We have the creators of that series, Sasha Coca, host for the California Report magazine, and Marisa Lagos, KQED politics correspondent, as well as host of Political Breakdown and often guest host here on Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more of your calls and comments right after the break.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We are talking about being mixed. We've got the hosts of a new KQED series, Mixed Stories of Mixed Race Californians, here with us, Sasha Coca and Marisa Lagos. You probably know them from their other work around the station. And we're also joined by one of the featured interviews of their series. We've got Dr. Jennifer Noble, who's a psychologist, educator, and coach for families with mixed race kids. We're going to get to more of your calls. You've been flooding the phone lines. Let's get to Rick in San Francisco.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, doing well. Welcome.
Great, thank you. I'm born in California, up in Solano County, 42 years old now, born in 1980. Growing up, I guess I did use fractions. I'd say I was half Mexican and half white. Mm-hmm. Ended up going to college and learning a lot more about just race as a social construct, and began to kind of blend, modify how I would say that. So now if someone asks, I say I'm a Euro-Latino blend.
Something more like that. Sounds something like a nice more cocktail. Like
coffee. Yeah, something like more like a coffee bean than a fraction. It's been actually very interesting going out in public as well, because I'm, I'd say, tan-skinned, but don't have any sort of clearly defined features. So a lot of people ask me, they'll look at me and they'll say, what are you?
The ubiquitous question we all get our whole lives, yes.
What am I? What are you? I don't know. I'm a person. And then they'll drill deeper and they'll say, what ethnicity? And of course, they mix up ethnicity, nationality, heritage, usually wrong. I'm going to say, well, what do you think? And what's been most surprising is, because I could be kind of anything, they most often guess what they are. They see themselves in me. And so I get Turkish, Egyptian, Armenian, Persian, things I've never have been. And I just sometimes I just roll with it.
Not in this life, Rick. Yeah, no, not in this life.
My sister and I always had that experience, like traveling in like Latin America and parts of Europe, where people always think we're from like one country over. Like, they know we're not from there, but they're like, you're close by, right? You know? Like,
you know, I mean, it's interesting. Thank you for that, Rick. I mean, I think sometimes people take what are you as a somewhat aggressive question. But one of the things that Rick's experience shows is, like, sometimes it's because people are sort of like, are you like me?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that can be what's behind that question. It's not always. Sometimes it's like, how should I be racist
to
you?
We haven't had good language around having these conversations in ways that are like, yeah. I mean, Dr. Jen, what do you think? Like, what's your opinion on, like, is it okay to ask someone?
Oh, I think it's, well, whether we say it's okay or not, people are going to do it.
True.
I'm not sure that we need to answer that. But I do think it's okay sometimes. I do think, like the caller said, you know, some people have curiosity that's coming from a personal place. I always say that the person being asked, often your gut will tell you which way they're asking. You know, that's the nature of a microaggression, right? You can hear the tones, you can hear, you can see body language, you can see eye contact, and you can realize, oh, this is not a friendly question. You are not trying to connect with me. You're upset in some way that I'm present. Or you are really curious, you're wanting to connect. And so therefore I may join that discussion. And I think, I feel like most mixed race people are okay with the question when it's curiosity, when it's, you know, friendly connection, genuine. But when it becomes a little.
Right. Not the, where are you really from?
Where are you really supposed to be not here?
Right. Exactly. Right. Right. Why do you exist? That's yes. Sometimes what it is.
Let's bring in Catherine from Oakland. Welcome, Catherine.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hey, welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. Sure can.
Thank you so much for giving all us mixed people a voice, or however we individually want to identify. So I'm Catherine. I'm a psychiatrist in the Bay Area, and I grew up mostly in Eugene, Oregon, and also spent summers in Chicago, which was like two completely different worlds. For me, because of my mix, which is African-American, Caucasian, and Cherokee. So I've gone through like a lot of different phases of identity, and a lot of it is based on how I'm perceived and how I'm accepted from external sources. So as a child, I was perceived as Black and had a lot of extreme anti-Black racism. Mm-hmm. And so my core identity is as a Black person, but there's also a lot of input from my mother, who's Jewish, and grandmother, who's Black and Native American. And so at first I was very accepted by the Black community and brought in and was definitely held at arm's length from the white community. And to mirror one of the previous callers talking about the one drop rule, that was very much my experience as a child growing up in Eugene, Oregon. But being a lighter skinned mixed person, as I got older, I found a lot of rejection and pushback from the Black community. Mm-hmm. And so then it kind of changed my identity. It's basically, what was I allowed to be? So there's a lot of silencing going on. There's a lot of what we deal with as mixed people is being perceived and labeled by external sources and then adopting those labels internally. But then when those labels change and shift and the acceptance levels change and shift over time, it kind of forces us to go beyond those labels and really figure out, who are we as a person, as a whole person, not as all these racial labels, right? So there's that aspect of it, going through all these different phases of labeling. But the question of safe spaces becomes very prominent for some of us, because it's not safe for me to run around and call myself a Black woman necessarily, depending on what space I'm in, because of my light skin color. It's not always a welcome thing for me to identify myself as. Because many times people, because of their own pain and suffering, would not understand that somebody who looks like me might also have racial pain and suffering. It's hard to welcome people who look differently than yourself sometimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so,
Catherine, thank you so much for sharing that experience, and also just sharing some of that, the pain of this, that I think a lot of people really do experience on so many different dimensions. I mean, head on a swivel, you're not sure where it's going to come from, depending on.
And sometimes it comes from your own family.
Right.
And that's, I think, some really deep pain, right? When people in your own family say, you know, you're not enough, or you're not quite this, or you're not quite that.
And then also the question of, like, I think some of this is experiential in terms of how we identify. So one of our guests is Sheree Moraga, this sort of legendary writer and artist, and she really identified more with her Mexican side because that's who was around her. Her mother's family, her father's family was basically absent. And so I think, like, sometimes that is just like this other layer of it, that like you may be this mix of all these things, but there might be one part of your heritage that you just really feel connected to because of those personal experiences.
Mm. You know, just on this, the kind of pain that can go along with this topic. I mean, Barb writes in to say, I'm a mother of a mixed child, Mexican German, and watching my child negotiate the bullying that he experienced was heartbreaking. He experienced prejudice because he has a complexion that does not, quote, match his last name. Teachers would often lump him into stereotypical groups. Students would say, you aren't a real fill in the blank. And he experienced so many assumptions about language. Recently, Santa Rosa experienced a high school homicide at Montgomery High School. And race and mixed race was a contributing factor to the bullying that the students on both sides were experiencing. It was just one factor, but it should not be discounted since the bullying issue is so problematic. Let's bring in Alex in San Francisco. Welcome, Alex.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, sure can. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm from a sort of intergenerational mixed race family. When people ask me, what are you, or some euphemistic version of that, I answer, my grandmother's from Japan. So my mom grew up Japanese and Irish in California, I'm 34, by the way. So my grandmother came from Japan right after World War II. So she was not accepted by like the Japanese American community. So my mom definitely experienced that rejection from, you know, both cultures, and she instilled in me kind of a deep suspicion of any group identity at all. I grew up outside of Boston, a really, really white area, and so my Asian ancestry was very prominent. But I grew up with that, just being like, oh yeah, that's like another part of my ancestry, and I felt kind of special. When I went to California for school, it sort of disappeared, and all of a sudden I was white, and that caused all this like internal drama of like, what am I? Oh my gosh. And now I have two kids with my husband, whose ancestry is mostly European. I gave them Japanese middle names to feel more connected to that history, but I kind of panic sometimes about like, oh my gosh, how are they going to identify? Like, I went to the doctor and I had to like check off what their race was, and I like sort of panicked at the doctor's office, and I was like, I don't know. I don't know what their race is.
Yeah.
Like, different in years. So yeah, I think it's...
Don't worry. Whatever you do when they're teenagers, they'll decide you did it wrong.
That's right.
Yeah.
But, you know, this next generation, I think, is really forging a whole new trail where they're just exploding the binaries. I mean, my partner's mixed. Our kids are Mexican, Japanese, South Asian, white. And you know what? Early on, they'd be like, oh, my hands are this, my nose is this. And I'd be like, no, it's not that. You're a whole person. But I think they're sort of like... whatever, like all their friends are mixed. They're kind of not, it's not as much of an issue for them. There isn't so much angst over it.
Yeah.
And I think by the time they're old enough to fill out the census, hopefully those boxes will have evolved so that they can feel like they're reflected even on those government forms.
You know, Dr. Jen, one of our listeners, Nancy, writes in to say, as the parents of two mixed race children, I'd like to know from all of you what you wish your parents would have done for you to help you develop or celebrate your racial / cultural identity?
Ooh, I think that's a great question. I mean, how much time do we have? Well, I think one of the most important things is just trying to present the whole picture to the child rather than explaining who they are to them. So it's just sort of like lay of the land. Here's all the things that you are. Here's what the world is going to do with it. Now, you know, take that and go kind of thing. I think that is a little bit, it allows the child to develop some critical thinking, to kind of understand the world. I always say, like, if you can have an inside scoop or secret with your child about the world, they love that. They become more connected to you and they feel like they know something that other people don't. So when you begin to explain, like, look, these are all the things that you are. You're four things, you're five things, you're two things. the world is going to be like, that's not possible. But isn't that wild? You already exist. So it is. And let's help you embrace that from a very young age so that when you get to the age where people try to press you and push you, you won't be as easily pushed and pressed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of love it because I feel like it allows, I mean, it's the most like Bay Area, most California identity to have this mixture of cultures and ethnicity and races. I mean, that is kind of what defines us here as a region, you know, that there's all these different kinds of people.
And it's kind of a superpower. I mean, Dr. Jen, you've used that word, right? That we're able to be a fly on a wall in different situations and move with fluidity between situations. And I think for me, it's helped me as a journalist. It's part of why I can have sort of an ability to move between communities and talk to people and have deeper conversations. Yeah. What I wish my parents had done, though, and I don't think it was their fault, it was my generation. I wish we had seen more families like ours reflected in movies and TV and sort of in the zeitgeist because we felt so other. You know, I there was nobody quite like us. And I think that is changing. And Dr. Jen, I know you've got, you know, books and movies that you recommend families watch. And there's just so much more. It's so much more in the, you know, in the milieu right now for people to be able to see that.
You know, one of our listeners writes with a bit of a different perspective. I'm a Bay Area native, mixed race, half white European and half Indian. I want to offer a slightly different perspective on what it means to be mixed race. I never felt confused, nor did I ever let the perceptions of others dictate how I felt about my cultural identity. Rather, I think it gave me the huge benefit, as we were saying, of seeing the dynamics of in and out groups of any kind, racial or otherwise, as arbitrary and counterproductive. It's easier for mixed race people to see how superficial and frankly silly it is to define and defend these groupings with such fervor. I hope that during this conversation, some listeners will be encouraged to move towards seeing everyone as an individual. We'll all be better for it. Thanks for that.
And we did really, I think one thing, you know, some of this is talking about the challenges of identity, but it's also the joy of
the
it.
Celebration
and,
of
and,
it.
And yeah, the ability, as Sasha says, I mean, yeah, that I can like, you know, make tamales one day and then make some sarma the next. Like it's because all of those parts of us are joyful. And to your point, Alexis, I mean, some of the best like food and culture in the Bay Area is based
music
on these mashups, right?
Yeah.
This mix is guap. Yeah, the rap artist originally from Oakland we have featured in this. And he just has an incredible story because he presents as black, but he was basically raised by his Filipino grandma. And so like, you know, we played earlier, Chicken Adobo is one of his songs. It's great. It's just so joyful.
You know, you're coming out of this project. I mean, you're not totally done with it yet, but a lot of it is in the can now. Do you think that you yourself, so I'm going to start with you, Marisa, have changed, has it doing this project changed the way you feel about your own identity?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's given me more permission to claim who I am. And I think it's inspiring me to kind of look deeper and have these conversations, hopefully, with my kids. And also to, like, be more understanding of other people because I think, again, like, my husband is mixed as well. And like he identifies in a way that I haven't always, quote unquote, agreed with. And like, that's not my job
that's
or role.
Right. You can't police
like,
that.
Yeah. It's opened my eyes in a way to be like, oh, right. Like he gets to decide as well. So it has. And I think, like I said at the top, I still have some like ambivalence. I still almost am sitting here for the hour being like, someone's going to call and be like, Marisa, you're not really mixed race. Like, but that's part of the process. And it's been, yeah, it's been a really cool kind of evolution to do and to continue these conversations.
Yeah, I mean, for me growing up, as I said, there were hardly any people with my mix. Like, you know, the South Asian community does not intermarry that much. That's changing now. Every little kid I see, you know, whose dad is a software engineer and mom is a white woman, I'm like, oh my God, can I just hug you and embrace you? But you know, I
don't
think,
go up to random kids and hug them.
But you know what? For me, I think Dr. Jen, you know, just the revelation from the conversation we had about fractions. I grew up in my family all the time saying half and half. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm whole.
Totally. Yeah. I told my mom, and she took it really well.
Oh, that's good. You're like, no more pie charts. No more paper plate, Mom. Thank you. Right. We have been talking about the experience of being mixed. There's a lot more where this came from. Sasha Coca, host for the California Report magazine, and Marisa Lagos, KQED politics correspondent, have created Mixed Stories of Mixed Race Californians. They can hear it on the California Report magazine.
That's right, and it's rolling out through the end of April. We've got 7 episodes. The first 2 are out, another one dropping today. Yeah.
We have also been joined by the excellent Dr. Jennifer Noble, psychologist, educator, and coach for families with mixed-race kids. Thank you so much, Dr. Jen.
Thanks for having me. This was so fun.
Thank you to all of our listeners. So many of you. Sorry we couldn't get to everyone. This Hour of Forum is produced by Blanca Torres, Grace Wan, and Catherine Monahan. Marlena Jackson-Rotondo is our engagement producer. Judy Campbell's lead producer. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our interns are Lulu Ralda and Jericho Reininger. Our vice president of news is Ethan Tovin Lindsay. Enjoy Denver and the NCAA tournament, Ethan. And our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another Hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.